It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We meet a UW-Madison mechanical engineering student who is one of 10 finalists in NPR's College Podcast Challenge. But first, more than 20,000 people living in Wisconsin have cases pending in immigration court that could result in deportation. But the vast majority of those people won't be represented by a lawyer. As Sarah Lear reports, there's a growing and unmet demand for immigration attorneys in Wisconsin and across the country.
On a recent spring afternoon, more than 30 people file into the basement of a church in Madison. Some carry babies in strollers and slings. They settle into plastic chairs as attorney Aisa Olivares of the Community Immigration Law Center cues up a slideshow.
La gente que tiene deportación anterior también no son elegibles por el asilo.
The people in the crowd are new arrivals to the U.S. Some are seeking asylum. That means they need to prove they left their home countries because they fear persecution for characteristics like their race or their politics. They typically have a year to turn in government paperwork. The form must be completed in English. And the process often involves recounting trauma, like imprisonment, sexual assault, or torture. They need help. But with only 3 attorneys on staff, the center doesn't have the resources to give one-on-one legal advice to everyone. Paralegal Diana Benitez says the nonprofit has no choice but to turn many people away.
It's desperate. It's just the level of desperation people have when they come to speak with you is just really, is palpable. It's just, you can see it on your face.
In 2019, there were more than 1 million pending U.S. immigration cases. Today, that backlog has surpassed 3 million. Sue Long directs the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, which analyzed the federal data. She says insufficient court funding is partly to blame.
They haven't had the budget to increase the number of immigration judges and support staff that are needed to hold hearings and make decisions, compared to increasing the budget, for example, for the Border Patrol.
And when immigrants end up in court, data also shows they're less likely to have lawyers. 5 years ago, immigrants nationwide had legal representation in 65% of pending deportation cases. Now, only 30% do. In the U.S., criminal defendants have a right to an attorney, but that right does not apply to immigration cases. Annie Chen is with the Vera Institute of Justice, a left-leaning think tank. She says the system has created an imbalance.
The government is always represented by a trained attorney, but the immigrant is often in immigration court alone.
When immigrants have attorneys, studies show they're more likely to be released on bond if they're detained. They're also less likely to be deported. Barb Graham oversees refugee and immigration legal services for Catholic Charities in Milwaukee. It's one of a handful of organizations in Wisconsin that handles immigration cases on a free or pro bono basis. Graham says her clients can't afford to pay thousands of dollars for complicated and lengthy cases.
People who are applying for asylum have left everything. They come up with nothing. They have no access to money. They have no access to, they didn't come with their bank account.
But even when people can't afford to pay, Graham says private immigration attorneys can be in short supply. Border Patrol encounters with migrants at the southern border reached a record high last year. And Milwaukee immigration attorney Teddy Chadwick says demand for his services has risen exponentially.
I have court hearings that are scheduled out till 2028 and 2029.
Faced with a backlog, Chadwick says there's often nothing immigrants or asylum seekers can do to make their cases go faster. And he says those cases can be all but impossible to navigate without an attorney. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore NPR's best college podcasts in America with more than 500 entries. And one of the 10 finalists is a UW-Madison student. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jack Oley is a senior, double majoring in mechanical engineering and communication arts. The podcast he entered is called All Good Things. Jack, welcome to the Ideas Network and congratulations.
Thank you, Kate. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so how do your majors inform what you did with your podcast?
Yeah, so I think the engineering and the communication arts are really my two passions, and I'm always looking to combine them because they're really different in school, right? I got a lot of different stuff going on. So when I look to like the podcast, I was hoping to make a podcast where I could channel kind of my interest in mechanical design, but, you know, still have it in the communication arts realm of podcasting and writing and things like that. So I kind of turned and pivoted to look at old technologies and kind of the evolution of technologies, some that I have learned in class and some outside of class, and then make that into a podcast to kind of, you know, educate people on the technologies of the past, the present, and then the future.
So it sounds like this podcast was a bit of a creative release for you. Like, how did you learn how to put a podcast together?
Yeah, so I learned how to podcast. I've been listening to podcasts almost my whole life, really since sixth grade. But I learned a podcast in a course here at UW-Madison called Sound Cultures and Podcasting. And that's where I learned about the production, the business side of podcasting, and was really introduced to the software and kind of how to go about the process of actually making one.
What draws you to make one versus just consuming the ones you love?
You know, I think I am a maker at heart. I think that's really why I'm both an engineer and a communication arts student. I like to produce things. I like to tell stories through my art, whether that be like a designed object or a script. And I think a podcast is a great medium to do that in.
So in NPR's announcements of the finalists, there was definitely a stress about the distinction in between scoring and just, you know, adding music as a layer to the bed of the podcast. How did you approach scoring and music?
Yeah, to me, the rules are pretty specific on that, which I found really interesting. Mm-hmm. And it had to be a lot of your own music or free music to use out there on the internet. And I think to me, music and just kind of like sound effects and everything is really crucial to a podcast and kind of what can distinguish it from radio in some ways, but also just to distinguish it from any other artistic medium. Building that soundscape, building that world that you can really be immersed in is something that I think is really essential to podcasting. So I really tried to focus on that and I really enjoyed doing the sound engineering aspect of that when making my podcast.
And as you said, you've called sound design one of your favorite aspects of the podcast. Let's listen to a portion of your submission when you're explaining the similarities between piano keyboards and the first typewriter keyboards.
These literary pianos had 14 black keys, each with a single letter reading from right to left.
E, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J.
And 14 white keys, starting with the letter O and reading from left to right.
O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W.
So why did this change?
I love that. I love the layers. And, you know, of course, I just want to know, where did you find those artificial QWERTY sounds?
Yeah. You know what? I think that was just a quick Google. I was like, what can make like a rope? In my mind, I was like, okay, keyboard, you know, like piano keyboard. So that's where the piano came from. In the background there, but then the voice was more like, well, it's a technology, but it's a technology that's typing like words, right? So what is something that can speak that sounds, you know, kind of like a robot?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and then in terms of the scoring of it, did you find original music? How did you find the actual music to layer?
Yeah, in the podcast class, we were actually given resources for free sound effects, free music, just websites that had it open source, which was awesome. And that, you know, I couldn't have made the music aspect of it without that. So those resources within the course really helped me kind of discover and figure out how to go about using the music properly and crediting the proper people.
We have UW-Madison senior Jack Oley with us, mechanical engineering and communication arts double major, podcast called All Good Things. It's a finalist in NPR's College Podcast Challenge. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts to the discussion, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.
Don't WPR is proud to bring you the latest news and information about the spring general elections scheduled for Tuesday, April 2nd. To find out how to register, where to vote, how to vote absentee, and more, go to myvote.wi.gov. Myvote.wi.gov is maintained by the State of Wisconsin Elections Commission.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. NPR names 10 finalists in its third annual National Podcasting Challenge for college students. A UW-Madison mechanical engineering student represents the best of college podcasting this year, and we talked with Jack Oley about his podcast called All Good Things. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jack, so as you researched the history of various technologies, did Wisconsin-made technologies influence your podcast?
I think that really influenced the first podcast I made, you know, with the keyboard, the QWERTY keyboard kind of being influenced and created by a Kenosha resident. I think that would kind of encourage me to do that first. I think it's always fun to have something that's, you know, homegrown, and it added an additional interest for me.
Absolutely. What did you learn, or how did you go about exploring a podcast about a keyboard? Because you could continue to research and add layers and layers of details. When did you know how to stop?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was the time constraint for the NPR competition, because it had to be between 3 and 8 minutes. And if you notice, mine's kind of on the shorter side. And that's because when I added more to it and I made it a little longer, I kind of got out of scope of the main focus of what I was talking about. And I really just tried to hit the key points, kind of the key historical facts in that short 3-minute segment. In the future, I'm hoping to have a little longer form podcast, which, you know, can dive more in depth and cover more information. But in the case of the keyboard, I just kept it short.
In terms of an audience, what length holds the interest of an audience? Is there kind of a magic amount of time, do you think, or does it vary?
I think for the kind of podcasts I'm going for, at least the ones I listen to that are like All Good Things, it's really kind of like a 10 to 20, really a 15 minute range where you can really hold the attention of the audience and they can retain the information. I feel like any more time than that and so many facts and dates are getting thrown at you that you kind of lose track and lose scope of what the podcast is talking about.
Who are your biggest influences in podcasting? Who do you crush on?
I think for All Good Things, you know, with the soundscape and everything, I was heavily influenced by Radiolab and 99% Invisible. Those were two I really drew from. And I listened to early on back when I was in sixth grade, and I continue to listen to this day. I just love those podcasts. I think they're fantastic.
Radiolab to me too. I mean, it is such a, you go on just such a journey with your ears. You really lead with your ears. Is that kind of what draws you to as well? That you just never know what you might hear next, and it's really kind of fast.
Yeah, I really love that about Radiolab. I also think the topics they choose are so interesting. And I'll just be walking down the street one day and see something and be like, oh, I remember that episode from 10 years ago that's about this. And I just think that the tying the soundscape with these interesting themes and concepts really helps them stick with me, at least.
Okay, so, and then 99% Invisible, you must be a fan of Roman Mars.
I am, yes.
All right, well, tell us why.
Well, I mean, I think like most people, I love his voice. I think his voice is fantastic. I also think 99PI, you know, coming from the engineering background as well as the communication arts, I think the design aspect of that podcast is really appealing to me. And learning about, you know, things in the design that you walk past every day, but you might, you know, not appreciate, and then learn to appreciate them through the podcast is just really rewarding and really enjoyable to listen to.
I think you would have a leg up as a mechanical engineer and having all these communication skills in your toolbox. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on how you look at it, right? Because it's, in some engineers don't view that as something that's important. I think it's something that's, you know, essential, at least to my existence. I believe that when I walk into a classroom and study film, or I walk into a classroom and study, you know, heat transfer, it's two different sides of my brain, but I'm, you know, I'm the same person. So I'm trying to make myself well-rounded, and I'm just kind of trying to be curious in all aspects of my life.
What did you learn about yourself as a writer through this project?
I learned, that's a great question. I think I learned writing for radio and podcasting is much different, I felt like, than writing for the screen. In terms of especially with the sound effects and everything, writing those cues and writing it. I feel like when I put pen to paper, though, I generally have a good idea of what I want it to sound like, and it's just trying to get it there through either the dialogue or the sound effects.
But you have to be able to hear your voice and be able to hear kind of yourself in a conversational way that's not stilted. And I would imagine that, too, is a process. I mean, we all have to grapple with that as well when we're trying to write scripts.
Yeah, I agree with you. I also think it's difficult to kind of distance yourself from the thing I've made. I went back and listened to the All Good Things, this episode I submitted just about last week, and I was hearing things. I was like, I should have changed that. I should have done this. I wish I had more time. It's hard to, you know, just put the thing down and be done with it.
I'd imagine. I think authors go through that too when they read their book again, or, you know, I've heard about making edits like in the bookstore or something like that. So, you know, were there bigger challenges you faced during production? You know, the time element is one thing you bring up.
Yeah, I think that the time was really difficult. Doing this kind of like Sonicscape, adding all these elements, it took a lot of time to find the right ones. I was really picky with what kind of sound, like the in the clip you played, I had the piano in the background, like the classical piano. Probably took me, you know, 4 hours just to find that one 30-second segment, because I really had a specific thing in mind. I wanted it to be just piano, wanted to have a high tempo, so it kind of kept the story moving, but I didn't want it to be staccato, so it would break in with my speech. So I think the time was the biggest constraint I had. The other one, I think number two would be just kind of the type of music I use, you know, only using free music or music made by myself. I kind of had to limit the use of what I maybe thought in my head.
Do you play an instrument?
I do, yes. I play trombone.
Ah, okay. We're talking about a podcast producing with Jack Oley. We're getting into the weeds here. UW-Madison senior NPR's College Podcast Challenge finalist. Call in questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You know, Jack, something I too grapple with is trying to find really good ideas that are good enough to bring to air. Pitches, you know, continually are something that I have to grapple with. How do you go about finding ideas for your podcast?
I think it's less of like trying to look for ideas, but more, you know, letting the ideas come to me. I'm not on the lookout. It's more I'm just sitting back. I cast my reel and I let things happen. So I'm walking through my everyday and I'm not thinking, what's my next idea? What's my next idea? It's more just like I'm walking through my everyday and it's like, oh, that would be cool. Or this is cool. I sat down earlier today and I was thinking about the keyboard as a podcast. And I was like, well, you know, our computer screens are rectangular. That's something else where it's like, oh, interesting. Why, you know, why is that? Why aren't they, you know, vertical or circular or something like that?
What are your tips for people new to podcasting who want to submit to like a podcast, to NPR's podcast competition?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend to listen to, not just mine, but all the finalists. I think they're all fantastic and they're all a great representation of what students can do in podcasting, at least at this time. And other than the student podcast, just listen to the podcast you like and things you're interested in. I think one of the biggest ways, you know, you can get involved in the medium is to just kind of immerse yourself in it and understand where it's going and what people have done with it.
Do people have an idea just how much time it takes to put one together?
I don't think so. I don't think I did, Kate. I know you listen to Radiolab and some of those episodes are as short as, you know, 15, 20 minutes, and then some, you know, some are longer form, but you listen to it and you don't realize that it's all the work it takes for the, you know, the researching, the interviewing, the recording, the post-processing, all this kind of stuff. It takes a lot of time.
How did you do that and fit it into your schedule as a double major? How did you make that balance work?
Yeah, that was difficult. The answer in this case was winter break. So I had a lot of free time over break, so I was able to really make this what I wanted it to be. Outside of that, it was helpful to have that class where I had the baseline. So I was already standing on level ground when I started building this podcast. I understood the technique, so I didn't have to learn how to record sound or anything like that.
Did you have any influence from professors, or did you get any feedback along the way as you were putting it together?
Yeah, I think my professor in podcasting, Professor Jeremy Morris, he was a great influence, and it really helped. He really helped me, you know, understand the history of podcasts, but also, you know, the production side, the business side of things in the course.
What is the business side of podcasting like? What did they tell you? Because that has had some, you know, ups and downs as of late.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Not, I don't think any students in the class, you know, were trying to make it full time at podcasting, at least, you know, at the time of the class. So mm-hmm. It's not like he was advising them on any major financial decisions, but it was more so, you know, trying to make a marketable podcast that can distinguish itself, because, you know, anyone can make a podcast at this point. So you need to make one that's a little unique, and then make it so that you'll have a viewership and a faithful viewership. People mm-hmm. keep coming back to listening to it.
Well, Jack, thank you so much for the conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Jack Oley is a senior at UW-Madison, finalist in NPR's College Podcast Challenge. His entry is called All Good Things. Check it out. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Washington Post Department of Data columnist Andrew Van Dam explains how his team analyzed a trove of Labor Department data to suss out the most physically demanding jobs in America. We get takeaways from this analysis, and you can join the conversation. Call in with a question, add your comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Geez, thanks so much.
So the Bureau of Labor Statistics compiles data about the country's jobs. Why does the government need this data?
Well, in this case, you know, they do a lot of things for like the unemployment rate and that kind of thing. Really boring standard stuff. But why are they looking into this ridiculously specific like requirements of every job in the country? Well, that is actually thanks to the Social Security Administration, who are funding a lot of this because they need that data for their disability adjudications. Because when someone applies for Social Security disability insurance, the SSA needs to determine, can that person do their previous job or can they do any other possible job in the country? Well, it's hard to make that determination unless you know exactly what goes into every possible job in the country.
But these job titles haven't been updated since 1977. I mean, you know, that's been a minute. What went on there? Did the federal government like just fall down on the job?
Yes, I suppose so, because there is this Dictionary of Occupational Titles, which I think it started like sometime before the Second World War and was last updated in 1977. That's what the Social Security Administration has been using to determine your disability ever since then, you know, for decades upon decades now. And it turns out the labor market has changed slightly since 1977. And so they were denying people their disability insurance because that person could actually work as, they claimed, a nut sorter, a dowel inspector, just the goofiest, most obscure jobs you can think of.
And I guess this project, this rabbit hole you went down, came out of, like, nut sorter data.
Yes, exactly. So what the Social Security Administration realized is the nut sorter data is not going to work for us. People are not impressed by, you know, getting their disability denied because they could sort nuts. And so what we need to do is find a new source that is perfectly tailored to the job at hand. So for years now, they've been working with the Bureau of Labor Statistics to actually create something that applies to the modern economy that is incredibly high quality data. And so they have put tens of millions, hundreds of millions into this big project. And for the past at least the past 5 years now, and honestly, it's been longer if you include all the crazy preliminary studies and all that, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been sending economists to businesses all around the country, tens of thousands of them, and asking exactly what goes into every one of these jobs, really drilling down and getting real useful data on the jobs that Americans actually do today.
So it's really the boots on the ground that is probably the difficult aspect here of why it's so hard to update obsolete jobs and add new ones?
Yes, it is an enormously expensive thing to send probably more than 70 trained economists all around the country to so many different businesses to spend hours at each business asking folks exactly what goes into this. Like, for example, how many hours would you spend sitting or standing at this job? Do you need to reach overhead? Does it require fine motor skills? All these things that you would need to know if someone's disability can prevent them from doing that job.
Okay, so then Andrew Van Dam arrives on the scene and you crunch some of the agency's data from surveys. So what are you trying to do here? What did you find out?
So I didn't know what I was trying to do at first. I just knew that there was this brilliant new data source that had dropped out of the sky. And when a brilliant data source drops out of the sky, you know, the siren goes off over here in Department of Data headquarters. And so I just raced to it. I ran the numbers every way I could, just looking, trying to understand what went into this, talking to the people who had collected the data, just getting the best feel I could. And one thing I could not escape was that no matter how you source this data, no matter what measure you look at, there is one job more than any other that just keeps coming up on top as the number one job. And so it is clearly the most physically demanding occupation in the entire country, at least by this measure, which I will say has some holes, because we were talking earlier about the enormously labor-intensive process taken to collect all this data. Well, you can only do that when a job has a certain number of workers, right? You need a critical, you need a large enough sample size. And so this is only for, say, the 478 most common jobs in the country. But of those, there's one that just far and away, almost no matter what category you look at, it's pretty comical, actually, how often this happens. But firefighters just shows up as the most physically demanding job in the country. So we create a little index to compare it to all the other jobs out there. And man, no matter what measures you put in this index, from climbing or crawling or kneeling or exposure to extreme heat, exposure to loud noise, like by so many of these different measures, firefighters come out on top or near the top.
Andrew Van Dam, Department of Data columnist, Washington Post, as we talk about the country's toughest jobs. Now let's bring in someone who does the country's most demanding job. Carlos Velazquez is a lieutenant with the Milwaukee Fire Department, where he is the fire education director. Carlos, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So you hear what Andrew is saying there. You hold the most physically demanding job in America by this analysis. What is difficult about your job? Take us inside the life of a firefighter.
Well, thank you. Thank you to Andrew for actually bringing this up to the light. It was actually very interesting reading the report that he put together and listening to the information that he was given. The truth is, when we look at it, I mean, yes, the job does require a lot of physical or it has a lot of physical and mental demands. If you ask me what is it that we do, it's so hard to put it on perspective. It is, you know, firefighters, the way that we like to see ourselves is more of problem solvers. You give us a problem, any type of problem. And there is no a set way. We don't have a book that says for this problem, this is what you're going to do. Every problem comes in different, from fires to vehicle accidents, people trapped, collapsed buildings, and every one of them has to be addressed specifically to the situation that we are faced with at the moment. I guess that the most demanding part of the job is the fact that we have to be up and ready and on our A game in a matter of seconds. At least here for Milwaukee Fire Department, we are, if you go to any of our fire stations, you're going to see that we have a timer right next to our garage door. And this timer, as soon as the call comes in, we have about 60 seconds. We have 60 seconds or less to get out of our fire station for any medical run, and 90 seconds to get out of the fire station for any other run, fire, car accident. And the only reason why we get the extra 30 seconds is because of all the gear that we have, all the coats and the pants and all the equipment that we have to add for this other run. So it doesn't matter if it's 2 a.m. and you are deep asleep, or if it's at 3 p.m, you have to mentally and physically be ready to go within 90 seconds.
I wonder if that unpredictable nature of the job of a firefighter leads to more physical strain and makes it more taxing because you just don't know what's going to happen in the next second.
Well, it's very interesting that you say that because the Frater and the Medical College of Wisconsin, in collaboration with the Milwaukee Fire Department and different departments in the area, have been doing studies where they have actually taken firefighters and study the sleep cycle, their heart rate, everything, as far as what goes, what happens inside our bodies at different times a day when we get those runs. And it is very interesting to see how the heart rate and the blood pressure, everything increases from the moment that tone goes off. And even when we are back at the station, that the physical adrenaline, if you will, continues. And it's one of the main reasons why about 46%, we have about 46% cases of cardiac arrest in the fire department. It's just something that out of all the different incidents or ways that we have lost firefighters in the line of duty or just related to the job, cardiac arrest is one of the highest ones, and it's because of that quick jump from being at rest, if you are, you know, doing something at the station or sleeping, and having to be on your way to a fire where people are trapped, and everything mentally takes a toll. You're listening to everything that's happening on the radio as the reports are coming in from dispatch and perhaps a company that already is on site, and you're hearing, okay, we have people trapped. So that kind of like it ups the sense of not stress, but the sense of urgency
and anxiety. Yeah. Andrew, I wonder, you know, you spoke with other firefighters for your reporting. What did you hear and what resonates with what Carlos is saying?
Absolutely everything. And my favorite part is that we actually have a measure from the Bureau of Labor Statistics for what Carlos is saying, that they measured the jobs that have the least control over their own work schedule. And firefighters is, of course, number one in the entire country. Another thing that came up a lot was exposure to hazardous materials, because it's not just cardiac arrest. Apparently, I was talking to the union folks, and they say that Cancer is another leading cause of death for firefighters, and that is because it is the job that has the is more exposed to hazardous materials than any other, according to this data set, at least. And it certainly rings true because, as they were explaining to me, you know, you and I, when we do our jobs, we're in a nice, clean, OSHA-approved work site. Even if I'm working in a kitchen or in a factory, you know, the inspector has gone through. We've had generations of people making sure this is safe. But you cannot send an OSHA inspector into a burning building ahead of the firefighters to make sure you've got a safe workplace. So they are working in a much more dangerous area, and they are doing it while carrying sometimes as much as 100 pounds of equipment. That's, you know, 45 pounds of basic gear and oxygen tanks and all that, plus a big old hose and any other technology or tools you need to bring up there. And so they're in this dangerous, often wet, often chaotic situation. So it takes a toll physically in terms of injuries and just simple wear and tear on your body. They were telling me that it's really not a matter of, you know, if you're going to get, you know, the sort of injuries that'll slowly make it harder for you to do this job. It's a question of when.
Andrew Van Dam writes, the Washington Post Department of Data column offers a perspective on how, you know, the most physical job in America, firefighters, and how journalists wrangle this data. We have Carlos Velasquez with us, lieutenant with the Milwaukee Fire Department, where he's the fire education director. Call in with a question. Share your on-the-job insights, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Washington Post dives deep into data sets from the Labor Department to measure the physical requirements of various jobs in America. The most standing, meat cutters, the wettest, dishwashers, also in the mix, animal caretakers, and nurse midwives. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Carlos Velasquez, who's a lieutenant with Milwaukee Fire Department, and Andrew Van Dam is Department of Data columnist at The Washington Post. Andrew, what other jobs are physically demanding in your analysis?
Oh, geez. So I guess a lot of them are very similar to firefighter, what you would think is jobs in the same family. That is paramedics, police officers, other first responders, fire inspectors, their bosses. All those jobs require that you need to be able to lift a lot of weight. You need to be able to push, pull, climb, all these different actions. Some other ones, though, that you would that aren't quite in that same family would be like roofers or RV mechanics, diesel mechanics, as you can imagine.
Carlos, did you ever consider any other jobs than firefighter?
yes. When I was very young, which it was quite a few years ago, to age myself, when we went to the fire stations as students from elementary schools, they would still let you slide down the pole with a firefighter, kind of like taking you down. That's not an option anymore. But firefighting was always very appealing to me since a very young age. After I finished high school, I went to school for engineering. Never did anything with engineering while I was at school. I started teaching at a local high school for 11 years, and then I became a firefighter shortly after 9/11. But yeah, engineering was there. Teaching has always been, I'm very passionate about teaching and education. So I have considered other jobs, but I really do enjoy the time that I have been a firefighter or that I have been with the fire department.
How often do you or your fellow firefighters get injured on the job?
That happens quite often. It is a physically demanding job. And thankfully, we do a lot of training. We do training within the fire station, the people inside the fire station. We do trainings with our battalions, which is usually just a combination of the five closest fire stations in different areas of the city. And we also do trainings with the whole department and other departments, other fire departments in the area that we collaborate with. Hmm. So we do a lot of training, but still the job, like Andrew was saying, is very demanding. Physically, yes, you know, putting the turnout gear, the coats, the pants, the boots, the SCBA, the breathing package and helmet and everything, you're talking about anything between 60 pounds to 100. That's without counting the hose and the tools and perhaps people that we have to help bring out or carry out. So injuries are very common in our career. We work through them, and we have a very good network, at least for us here, that takes care of our bodies and make sure that we are physically able to continue doing the job safely.
Let's bring in Jim in Kenosha with a question. Jim, hello.
Yes, I don't have any doubts about how dangerous a fireman's job is, and they're the ones that actually run toward the fire. But I want to do a shout out to farm workers. I always thought that was a pretty dangerous job. You think of agriculture, you think of all that equipment, you think about injuries there.
Yeah.
Is the one reporter still there?
Yes, of course. Andrew, what about farming?
Oh man, so that is to me the biggest hole in this survey, because as my dad, a dairy guy, pointed out early and often, we don't have as much data on those jobs due to sample size issues, and so they combine farming, fishing, and forestry into one big job, and it comes out as quite physically demanding, but it means we can't break out and just look at the milkers or the farmhands or any very specific, or the commercial fishermen or lumberjacks, two enormously demanding jobs that we just don't have as much data on.
But the milkers and all of the other crew, they happily welcome you to their dairy farms here in Wisconsin, Andrew. They'd even let you try.
Oh man, I thought getting up for this interview was going to be if I was milking again.
Well, we have a very limited amount of time, but I know that you get your curiosities from out in the world, and they help you go down these data related, you know, mysteries. Is there like an appeal you can make to all of Wisconsin about what you're searching for and what you want people to bring to you?
Absolutely. So we build so many of our columns on questions, whatever a reader is curious about, they send in just the most goofiest random questions, like how many bachelors have bachelor's degrees? Well, that's actually a pretty good question. We might look it up sometime. How many Grammy Awards go to the most listened musicians? All these different things people wonder about, just go to the Washington Post, send them to me, and we might dig into them in the next column.
Oh, thank you both for joining us. Andrew Van Dam, Department of Data columnist at the Washington Post. Carlos Velasquez is lieutenant with Milwaukee Fire Department, where he is the Fire Education Director. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Biologists discover a species of daddy long legs with remnants of four extra eyes that could give new clues into how arachnids evolved and the discoveries they're published in the journal Current Biology. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Prashant Sharma is an associate professor of integrative biology at UW-Madison. Prashant, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, thank you so much for having us on.
Yes, and we also have Guilherme Gainet, who is an affiliated biology postdoctoral student at Harvard Medical School and a former grad student at UW-Madison. Guilherme, welcome.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here today.
Well, Guilherme, let's start with you. You say that the extra eyes you discovered on daddy long legs are unable to see. Why would that be?
Well, so those eyes are very, very reduced when compared to what the ancestor had. And the primary reason why we think they can't see is because we don't really see lenses as we see in the functional eyes. So those eyes are under the cuticle and very reduced, just a few cells. But we can't really rule out that they are completely non-functional. This is something that we are interested in investigating, but certainly they can form images as you would expect for fully functional eyes.
How are you able to locate these hidden eyes under the microscope?
Well, so that was a very interesting and serendipitous discovery. One of the happiest moments of my of my life as a scientist. So we were studying the eyes of these creatures, studying some of the genes and how they compare to how the eyes are made in other arthropods, such as insects. And then I needed to find a way of really understanding in the embryo what tissue was really the eye tissue compared to the rest of the head. And then we decided to look at this type of proteins that we all have in our eyes. They're technically called opsins. They're needed for our vision, in our vision and any other animal. And when we use some fluorescent probe tags that allow you to see where these specific proteins are expressed, where they occur in the body, then those cells light up, and then we could see it super clearly. And it was a moment that I jumped from my chair in the confocal microscope in the dungeons of the of the building, and called Prashant without telling him what I was seeing, and then he came downstairs, and we were really happy.
Prashant, can you describe that moment in understanding a little bit more about what the daddy long legs might have evolved from?
Oh, sure. It was some combination of a meltdown and deja vu. The meltdown, because it was such a surprise, and I did not see that coming. The deja vu came from the observation that the same state of having multiple eye pairs was last seen in a 305-million-year-old fossil that we described 10 years ago. So a paleontologist colleague of mine and I had described this species from the Carboniferous. It had been sitting in the Paris Museum for something like 25 years or so before we discovered it. And it was scanned using X-ray computed tomography. And what they found inside of this little nodule inside of the space was a small-bodied fossil that had what looked like two pairs of eyes. And this suggested to us that the ancestral condition of this species was, or of this group, was two pairs of eyes, right? And this is the kind of thing that you would see in groups like spiders and scorpions. But the understanding for the entire body of literature since Western civilization has known about daddy long legs is that they only have one eye pair. Hmm. So encountering this in a living species, it very strongly connected.
Oh, Prashant, you're breaking up there. Can you hear us? I think we're having some technical difficulty there. I'll reintroduce you as we talk about daddy long legs with Prashant Sharma, associate professor of integrative biology at UW-Madison, and Guilherme Gainet, who is a postdoc student at Harvard Medical School. Over to you, Guilherme. You know, how often do arachnids have these vestigial eyes that they can't really see from?
Well, so it's not very common, if I recall, in the literature for these vestigial eyes to be present. I can recall one study in scorpions that they have one of their eyes reduced, but that's certainly not something that that is common. So when we discovered that structure, we were really, really surprised. What is common, on the other hand, is the loss of one or other type of eye. So that's a very interesting process that we see across many different groups of arachnids, and particularly in animals that live in caves. So some of the things that we were also studying in a separate project was how spiders lose their eyes in caves. What genes are turned off and what processes are required for that loss? That happens really convergently across many different groups of animals, but spider eyes have never been investigated under this perspective.
Why should we care that daddy long legs have extra eyes? I mean, why is that meaningful? Why is that a meaningful discovery?
Well, there are a couple of different reasons, and I'm going to start with the most specific one. So for us that study the biology of daddy long legs and are excited about this fascinating group, so really a natural history and understanding of the life that lives, that occurs in our planet, right? Mm-hmm. So if we think about daddy long legs, so this fossil that Prashant was discussing about, it's one of the oldest groups of harvestmen ever described. So it's a very old fossil. And when it was described, it was thought that this group was related to a small group of harvestmen that have very tiny legs. They're commonly known as the mite harvest. But now that we discover that this other group, the group of the daddy long legs, that includes the animals with very long legs that you're more familiar with, now that we discover that they have this condition that we see in the fossil, that strongly suggests that the fossils are instead more closely related. So they have a more recent ancestor with this group that has the long legs. So that shifts the family tree of this entire group and all our estimates of how old the group is. And this has a lot of downstream implications. So, for example, that pushes the age of this group to a different geological age, to the Devonian. Hmm. So, and with a lot of downstream implications of what we think about the animals that might have been living together with these fossils and with the daddy long legs when they first evolved. That's one of the implications, yeah.
We have Guilherme Gainet at Harvard Medical School and biologist Prashant Sharma at UW-Madison made discoveries about a species of daddy long legs, finding these additional hidden eyes. Call in with a question. You can share comments about arachnids, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The spider relatives of daddy long legs, they have more than two eyes, and now researchers find remnants of additional eyes on daddy long legs, indicating they're roughly 50 million years older than previously thought. Call in with a question. Add comments. 800-642-1234. We have Guilherme Gainet, who is a former UW-Madison graduate student, and Prashant Sharma is here, associate professor of integrative biology at UW-Madison. Prashant, you know, your research reminds us that daddy long legs are not spiders, but a different kind of arachnid. What makes them different from spiders?
Among the things that will distinguish them from spiders, you will find that this is a group that does not spin silk. So they do not have spinnerets, they do not have spigots, and they don't produce silk, nor do they have venom glands. So however fearsome they might appear, this is a group that is not harmful to you in any way. The one characteristic that they will have, which spiders will not, is that they will have these repugnatorial glands, these secretions that make them really stinky to predators. And this is the defense mechanism that you find in all daddy long legs.
I was surprised by just the sheer number of species of daddy long legs, like scientists identifying 6,500 and there's more to go. Could these extra eyes be on all species or just some, Prashant?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. So one of the things that Guillermo was really curious about was whether this discovery of extra eyes in the species that we find everywhere, all over, you know, Bascom Mall and all over Wisconsin garages and lawns and so forth, is that something that you find in any of the other 6,500 species? So one of the things that he did was travel to Brazil, and he found embryos of some of the much more ornate species that occur in one of the other important suborders. And overnight, he developed resources to investigate their embryology. And what he found looking at the opsins he was talking about earlier is that they too have remnants of lateral eyes. So this is not a condition that's restricted to the most commonly occurring daddy long leg species. This is something you'll find, as far as we can tell, across a suborder that spans the Devonian and age. We don't think it's restricted to one species.
Oh, wow. And I would imagine, Guillerme, that was something you really wanted to find out, whether, you know, this could carry over from one species to the next in other areas of the world.
Yeah, so we were, once we discovered that species, we were really curious. So one of the first things we did, we decided to investigate some daddy long legs or harvestmen from Brazil. I'm originally from Brazil, and it's the country with the highest diversity of species that you're mentioning about. And so we went to the rainforest and collected some of these animals in collaboration with my Brazilian colleagues. And we were very excited to see that those proteins I was alluding to in the other question, they were also shining on that spot where we discovered the eye. So we do think this is widespread in the group. So it's just opening a window to investigate this right now.
Well, here's the thing. When I look at a daddy long legs, I'm enthralled by the legs and just the intricacy of their movement as they move about their environment. I mean, I just love watching that. And I'm wondering, you know, maybe their legs, maybe their legs became so much more sensitive and helpful to them navigating the world that their eyes kind of took the back seat. Their eyes maybe became more of a less sensitive organ or maybe a bit lazy. Is there any type of hypothesis in that?
That's a very, very cool suggestion. Certainly, the reduction of eyes it tends to be associated with changes in, you know, the habits of the species. For example, usually predatory species have very good eyes. In the case of the, for example, the jumping spiders that are very effective predators have very good vision, and they can really use that for hunting. So it may be something related with, you know, the feeding habits of daddy long legs. That they rely more on some other senses, such as olfaction and chemical senses for scavenging in the forest. So it may certainly be related to that. But at this point, it's really just speculation, because it's an event that happened millions of years ago, that at least began happening millions of years ago. So we need to think more about what the causes may have been.
Yeah, Prashant, I mean, could this give insights into the preferences of daddy long legs and how they handle their environments?
I imagine that one of the clues that we have here has to do with how they're using these different opsins, these universal photoreceptive proteins in those different groups of eyes. And one of the things that we found is that these vestigial eyes of that don't bear any lenses seem to be expressing UV opsins or UV sensitive opsins. These are the kinds of opsins that other arthropods like scorpions would use in those same, the counterparts of those eyes for detecting day-night cycles and establishing circadian rhythms. So it's entirely possible those eyes are functional. It's just, even if they're not image forming. And how exactly we want to get to that question, well, we tried a couple of experiments, which we ended up not publishing. There came a moment where we tried to paint the eyes or the different regions of the head of these harvestmen with, you know, two different kinds of nail polish. We had black nail polish and we had clear nail polish. There's a really funny story here about how Guillermo and I went to Target and we're trying to figure out exactly which nail polish product to buy for this experiment. but fortunately, we got a lot of help from the undergrads in picking out the right brand.
what we found, as far as we could tell, we didn't find any evidence that these vestigial eyes are image forming. We have no reason to believe that they respond to light the way that the true eyes do. But we never got as far as testing for circadian rhythms. And that just has to do with the short lifespan of these species. They don't seem to survive for more than a few weeks in the lab.
But it sounds like we need to think beyond what the traditional eyes do, because it sounds like the eyes for daddy long legs, hidden or not, could have multiple jobs that we're just not really thinking about.
Right, right, right. Well, Guilherme's ongoing work and some of the projects he'll be pursuing in the future is taking on a more comparative nature. And I think he can tell you a little bit more about some of the things he's trying to do with horseshoe crabs, which also have multiple sets of eyes. And some of these have been explored in greater detail. But until now, we've never found anything like the horseshoe crab eye complement in any living arachnid. And then he stumbled into it with his daddy long legs. But I'm hopeful that these comparative bodies of work will give us some insights about how these eyes have been deployed differently in different parts of the arachnid tree of life.
Talking about the arachnid tree of life with Prashant Sharma, Associate Professor of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, Guilherme Gainet is a postdoc student at Harvard Medical School, formerly at UW-Madison. Call in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. So, Guilherme, where does this take you? Where does this research take you? What are the next mysteries to solve here with the evolution of arachnids?
Well, there are certainly more questions now than answers, as usual with science. So one of the things I'm very interested about the eyes of the arachnids is how they transition from becoming from an ancestor state that looks something like a fruit fly eye with several that we call compound eye that is formed of multiple facets. How they transition from that condition into a camera type eye that we see nowadays in daddy long legs and jumping spiders, and more similar to the design of our eyes in a way that there's a single lens. How that event happened, what changes, which genes were changed through evolution that were responsible for this transition. And group that hasn't really been well studied with this respect are horseshoe crabs, and they are a key lineage for understanding this transition because they are the only chelicerates, which is this broader group with the arachnids, that retains that ancestor state. So if you look at the eyes, the lateral eyes of a horseshoe crab, they also have facets very similar to what you see in a fruit fly. So among the things I'm starting this summer and some work that I'll be conducting at the MBL here close to Boston, is studying the genetic basis of the development of these compound eyes with this long-term goal of understanding how you can go from a compound eye into a camera type eye. It's a very important evolutionary transition in this group.
Could that evolutionary transition have repercussions on how we treat perhaps eye diseases now?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a possibility. You know, a lot of what we know about congenital diseases and involved in eye diseases, we discovered from studying fruit fly genes. You know, several of these genes are important for a fruit fly eye, are also important for our eyes. So the more we know about the genetic regulation of how eyes develop, the more chances we have of understanding what goes wrong in the genes when you have problems in the development of eyes. So that's not something that I'm immediately focusing on, but that's the beauty of basic research. When you're looking sometimes for broader processes, you discover things that are fundamentally universal and can be applied to human health down the line.
Okay, so Prashant, in the interest of basic research, what do you do when you see a daddy long legs crawling in your home?
What do I do with it? Depending on the species, I'll usually let it outside, or if it's of importance to us, I'll just bring it to the lab and include it in our colony.
How many are in your colony now, may I ask?
The zoo is becoming it's becoming a little bit unmanageable. At the moment, we've got far too many arachnids of unusual flavor, among them vinegaroons, which is a group of arachnids that will spray acetic acid at you. But then we've also got a student who's working on snail biology and on how terrestrial snails have developed a lung and how they made landfall. So that this speaks to broader questions about terrestrialization. So I think we've got far too many animals in the zoo, and summers are particularly bad for that because I think the students just get way too excited, and then next thing you know, we're keeping too many species in the lab at the same time.
Oh, we've enjoyed this so much. Thank you both for joining us and sharing your research.
Well, thank you so much for having us on.
Yes, thank you so much. That was lovely.
Guilherme Gainet, affiliated biology postdoctoral student at Harvard Medical School, formerly of UW-Madison. Prashant Sharma, associate professor of integrative biology at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lake Superior's 5 national parks contain treasured resources, and now these parks deploy a plan to cut their emissions with the help of the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation. Be part of this discussion about parks going carbon neutral. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Irvine is Executive Director of the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning, Kate. Great to be here.
So if national parks in general, have a relatively low carbon footprint, how ambitious is this goal to go carbon neutral?
Well, it's actually very ambitious. And you're right, the carbon footprint of most of the national parks is honestly negligible, but they are a tremendous example to the public. It's where the public meets and recreates in these just iconic natural resources, and it's a learning opportunity, a teaching opportunity for the parks to share these concepts with the public. But there's also a practical need to move toward a carbon neutrality in the parks, especially with the accelerating warming climate, especially in the Lake Superior in the North Country, fire dangers and just the changing environment. Ecosystem around these parks is pretty rapid and dramatic, and the need to move out of fossil fuel powered heating sources to machinery and equipment is kind of essential. So
where do national park emissions come from? Where are the sources?
Well, kind of a good example that really started this whole initiative for us was at Isle Royale National Park, which is the most remote and hard to reach national park in the continental United States. It's an island park. It's actually part of Michigan, but it's about 20 miles offshore from Grand Portage, Minnesota. And Isle Royale operates off of diesel generators. So people visit the park and they're up there for their unique, amazing, hard to get to wilderness adventure. And in the distance, they hear the hum of diesel generators powering the infrastructure of that island. And that's been a kind of a thorn in the side of both visitors and park employees for years, but there's never been a sustainable effort to transition from diesel and carbon powered usage to solar, which, you know, there's been solar efforts started but never completed. And our project really started with a vision to complete that work at Isle Royale. And then from there, we had a very generous private donation to this work who said, well, if you're going to do one, why don't you do all 5 year? Why don't you do the whole lake, which would be all five of the national park units on the lake? And
it just makes me wonder, though, you know, to get to some of these remote places, you do need to go by boat. Are boats part of this plan as well, the transportation piece?
Well, that's a great question. Our project is really starting with the land-based infrastructure and land-based vehicle usage. Mm-hmm. Boats, especially on Lake Superior, carbon electric boats or hybrid boats are just not shell ready yet.
Mm-hmm.
The technology is coming up rapidly, but that's not available yet. But that's definitely on our game plan. It's just not on day one.
You mentioned there's a philanthropic partner to get to carbon neutral for these five national parks. Can you talk about the funding in order to get to decarbonization?
Well, initially, when we started this project, we thought that the ratio of public to private support for the project would be heavily oriented toward federal funding based on the IRA climate and energy monies and the bipartisan infrastructure money.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And what it's really turned out to be, the early phases of the project have primarily been supported by private foundations and private individuals. So, and that's been very robust, and there's a lot of public interest in getting behind this project. It's working with the federal government is not it's not a rapid process. It takes a while, and there's a lot of there's a lot of pieces that fit together to allow federal funding for major projects like this. And so what we're using private funding for is just to kind of grease the skids and knock off some of the easier projects that can be done rapidly.
But I wonder, having that private support perhaps also gives a bit more more of a seat at the table with the national park system and the federal government. It allows perhaps some more leverage to get to this goal.
Absolutely. 100%. When you walk into a negotiation with, with a fairly large donation ready to go toward this, you immediately get some attention. And most of the funding for National Park Service projects typically are matching grant projects, require matching grants. So, we walk to the table with donors ready to match, and that helps move things along quickly.
Tom Irvine, Executive Director of the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation, with us to talk about environmental sustainability, carbon neutral goals at the five parks that ring Lake Superior. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, let's discuss timeline here. Last year, your organization said the plan is to decarbonize the parks by 2027. How realistic is that timeline?
I probably wouldn't hang my hat on that timeline now, mm-hmm. honestly, but it's moving. It's there's this actually very positive friction between the speed that the private donors and foundations want to put behind this project and the not quite that same cadence that the federal government works at. So it's, I think between the two paces, we're going to definitely be able to move this project faster than a typical federal agency project.
You mentioned the diesel generators, and you've said how you intend the plan to be an inspiring model for park visitors to lower their own carbon footprints. So what might people see, or what models could people see as they visit these parks?
Well, this whole project is built on concept. They're not even concepts. They're proven technologies and proven ideas that homeowners could do themselves. It's based on really the initial phase is just basic energy efficiency in windows, insulation, lighting, things that the parks can do that people can do at home too. But then it's moving from there to transitioning HVAC systems from carbon-powered HVAC, you know, natural gas or propane or heating oil furnaces to air source heat pumps, electric air source heat pumps, and really moving things to clean electricity.
Tom, what will happen to garbage thrown away at these parks? As you know, that waste has a carbon footprint as well.
Yes, it does. It has a big carbon footprint. And as part of the National Park Service's Green Parks Plan, there's a very comprehensive plan within the Park Service for eliminating single-use plastics and minimizing that garbage footprint. But it's all part of it, for sure.
Tom Irvine leads the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation, which supports 5 national park sites. Call in with a question, share comments about a net zero emissions goal at these national parks. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation, in concert with the National Park Service, announced that 5 park sites are implementing plans to get their operations off fossil fuels and achieve net zero emissions. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We have Tom Irvine with us, Executive Director of the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation. Tom, you know, as you look out to Lake Superior, we've got the warming of the water. We have a really warm winter on record. How urgent is this change for the national parks around Lake Superior?
It's critical. So many of the cultural resources or the historic structures on the lake in Wisconsin's Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, the lighthouse, the lighthouses and the docks and historic facilities that are part of that that island park are all under climate siege due to the warming, both the warming temperatures and lake water temperatures. So it's critical. And right now, certainly within our parks in the North Country, just the impending fire danger for this season, this upcoming season, due to kind of the lack of winter this year and the lack of snow cover is a big concern.
Meanwhile, the National Park Service says more than 325 million people visited national parks around America last year. How busy do you expect this year's tourism season to be for Lake Superior National Parks?
Busy. Mm-hmm. It's already starting out busy. I think a lot of people have heard about the spike in Park Service visitation during COVID, and then it slacked off a little bit last year, but it has come back. It is coming back strong this year. The five parks that we represent are expecting visitor probably over 3 million visitors this year, which would be a pretty healthy increase over last year.
Wow.
So
what impact would that have perhaps on your foundation and the work that you're trying to do?
Well, hopefully it'll have a positive impact. And it's kind of up to us to get the word out and provide educational materials and really for us to work with the Park Service on educating their rangers and their seasonal staffs on what this project's all about.
So are visitors to these parks like Apostle Islands and Isle Royale, as you talked about, Grand Portage, you know, are visitors expected to change their ways as they enter and use these parks? I mean, what might change about a visitor's experience in coming years versus how they visited these places in the past?
Well, I think it's important for the visitors to kind of be mindful when they do visit the parks anyway, whether we're doing this project or not. Visit the parks with they're all of our parks. We all own them. They're national treasures, but be respectful. You know, do as much research as possible before visiting the park, and then I think, you know, visitors will have a much better experience. They'll be able to navigate their way around the parks more successfully, knowing in advance where they're going to go and what they want to see. And more of the visitors today are visiting up for shorter periods of time. And that, you know, that can create some pressure on the parks that didn't exist before. But I think for the most part, people understand that these are national treasures and they need to be maintained and protected. And anything that most of them can do, they want to do. So a big part of that is just like day one, don't bring single-use plastic into the park, period. And some of the parks are getting more really forceful about kind of mandating that too. So
I wonder, do you hold a special attachment to Lake Superior or have a personal connection to the lake?
That seems like a loaded question, Kate. Mm. Quite possibly. No, I have. I actually have lighthouse keepers in my family that go back to the 1880s. And just about every lighthouse on the lake, someone from my family was the keeper or assistant keeper at over the years. So Outer Island and Michigan Island, at the Apostle Islands, Au Sable Lighthouse at Pictured Rocks, Rock of Ages at Isle Royale, the lighthouses in Duluth. So yeah, it's a pretty special place for me and my family.
I'd imagine if anyone is bearing witness to climate change, it's those lighthouse keepers.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have the stories and the journals from the way it was.
Yeah.
There's not the lighthouse keepers that's not a job that exists on Lake Superior any longer. Everything's been automated, but it's a big change, and mm-hmm. and the stories of the way the climate on the lake and the challenges before are pretty epic.
We're talking with Tom Irvine, who's here, executive director of the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation, and efforts by these parks to go carbon neutral. Call in questions and comments at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, in terms of the ice caves of the Apostle Islands that have been closed due to unstable conditions, how can people safely enjoy the caves?
Well, unless there is safe ice cover on the lake, you're not going to see the ice caves mm-hmm. in the wintertime. If you are a paddler, you can experience the caves in the summer season. If you are an experienced kayaker or paddler or by boat, you can walk above the sea caves on the mainland side of the park. There's hiking trails that traverse the sea caves. You don't have a full view, but you get a good idea. So
2015, was that the last time stable ice allowed access to the ice caves?
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Were you out there then the last time?
No. I have to admit I was not.
So in
but,
our...
But I have yeah. had a peak during the winter when the ice was was not so stable, and I don't think I would do that again.
In our last moments together, what could the Park Service be doing better to care for Lake Superior and its national parks?
Well, I think it's above the Park Service. I think it's providing adequate funding for the parks to operate, for the parks to have adequate staffing and adequate finances to fully manage the parks. They've been kind of funding starved for a lot of years right now, and I certainly advocate having the public write to their senators and Congress people to support adequate funding. Mm-hmm. Parks. It's necessary. They're a treasure.
Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Irvine is executive director of the National Parks of Lake Superior Foundation. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Mm-hmm.